Today we're talking about a few different public health issues. First, this Friday, the state institutes new regulations governing the sale and purchase of raw milk. That's unpasteurized and usually cow or goat's milk.
I think they're uncalled for. I don't think there's any reason other than the government wants more control.
That's one Dixon farmer's perspective. We'll speak with her, along with the Illinois Department of Public Health and the CDC, about the public health side of this. Later, young children especially like a flu mist instead of a vaccine. Why?
It's quick and completely painless.
And ineffective. That's according to the CDC. We'll talk to a pediatrician about why. Finally, as we approach the end of the fiscal year for Illinois, we speak with a group of university professors who just had more than 200 of their colleagues throughout the state sign a letter that blames Governor Rauner for the current budget impasse. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we're talking about raw milk. Raw milk comes from many different animals, most commonly cows and goats. People buy the milk directly from dairy farmers in its unpasteurized form. And come Friday, July 1st, there'll be new regulations in place for people who sell raw milk in Illinois. This can be a contentious issue today, so today we wanted to speak to all sides of this. Later, we're going to be speaking to public health officials from the state and federal government. And as always, you're welcome to join in our conversation. If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. As always, you can tweet your questions. You can post them on Facebook. Search for the 21st and post your comments there. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We wanted to talk to the people. We can start by talking to the people who are producing the actual milk. We're joined now by Renee Koster. She's on the line from her family's farm in Dixon. Also joining us today from Springfield is Rebecca Oslin. She's a policy associate with the Illinois Stewardship Alliance. That's an advocacy group that promotes sustainable and local food systems. Renee, Rebecca, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Renee, I wanted to start with you. Why do people like to drink raw milk?
Well, most people that buy raw milk actually are buying it for the health benefits. There's a lot of people, a lot of my customers, that when they drink pasteurized milk, they actually get sick. They might have, you know, stomach issues, gas, bloating, asthma type action, sinus problems, or they're just trying to be healthier, drinking something that they can more easily digest. So a lot of people that have problems drinking pasteurized milk can actually drink the raw milk with no problem.
Was that the case for you, Renee?
I never had a problem drinking milk. I mean, we grew up milking cows. There were a few years when we didn't milk cows, so we bought it from the grocery store, and we took back a lot of milk because it didn't taste right, and we finally realized that's just how it tastes. So
That's how pasteurized milk tastes. It tastes different to you.
The taste wasn't the same.
Rebecca,
Rebecca,
what about you? Why you drink raw milk? What brought you to drinking raw milk?
Well, I actually had been interested in drinking raw milk for years, but really hadn't found it convenient to make that happen until I got involved in this advocacy. And then obviously I got to meet a lot of raw milk farmers and finally got to try it. And I found it just so much richer and creamier. I enjoy the extra flavor that's in it. I also try very hard to get a lot of the food that my household consumes right from the farmer. So I really liked that being able to buy raw milk really fits into that model. We get meat, we get vegetables right from the farmer. Why not our milk, too?
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I've never had raw milk, so I wonder if you all can explain to me what it tastes like. Rebecca, you started. You said it's a little creamier. It tastes different. Renee, why did pasteurized milk taste different to you?
I think what made it different was partially the plastic containers that it's in at the store. That light from the display case actually oxidizes the fat, and it gives it that kind of cardboard taste, the pasteurized milk. So the raw milk doesn't have that flavor. It has the true flavor of the fat that's in it. And like Rebecca said, it's whole whole raw milk that you get from the farm is going to be at least 3.5% fat, excuse me, if not more, where whole milk that you purchase in the store, they keep it consistently at 3.5% fat, I believe. So raw milk probably tends to have more fat in it too, which gives it a better flavor.
That's Renee Koster. She sells raw milk from her family's farm in Dixon. We're also speaking to Rebecca Oslin with the Illinois Stewardship Alliance. They're an advocacy group that promotes sustainable local food systems. We're going to be talking this hour about the research into raw milk and nutrition and safety. If you have questions or comments for us, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show. Rebecca, you're a lawyer with this alliance, and as you said, you became involved in some of the conversations around the regulation that took place with the Illinois Department of Public Health and with the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules. How did the move to regulate raw milk in Illinois come about?
Well, actually, a few years ago, I'm not sure where the impetus for this began, but the state basically reevaluated, they reinterpreted the statutes governing the sale of milk and said, oh, actually, even though we've had this loose policy guidance that raw milk producers have been selling under for the last 30 years. Actually, now we read the statute to say that raw milk sales are only allowed per the regulations written by the Illinois Department of Public Health. There never were regulations written, therefore sales are illegal. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't start enforcing that. That would have been very unfair to the producers to all of a sudden say, well, there's this technical change, and therefore you're all breaking the law. So they did give some flexibility for people during this process of writing the regulations, and that took place over several years. That was prior to me being at Illinois Stewardship Alliance, but my predecessor was working. He was working with a group of raw milk producers and some national advocacy organizations to try to at least craft the rules in a way that was less burdensome on the producers. We did have an administration change in the meantime, and some of the provisions became a little bit less stringent on producers after that. However, the way that they ended up being finalized, we still had a lot of issues with them, as did the local public health department. So in the end, sort of everybody was unhappy, but it's still.
So what's your sense of what the regulations are right now? Can you give us a brief summation of what the regulations involve?
Essentially, the producers have to comply with various standards for the facilities in which they milk. There can't be poultry in the room. There have to be smooth, easily cleanable walls, just specifics like that. There were provisions such as there could be no visible dirt on the cow's belly, flank, or udders, which is a little bit, it's very impractical for a working farm animal's lounge. You do certainly clean the parts that matter, but to have a standard of no visible dirt would be really impossible.
And is that part of the standard, or that's not part of the standard?
They softened up some of those standards a little bit in response to our concerns. The raw milk producers were worried that really stringent standards like that would open up the door for inspectors to say, oh, you know, there's a spot of dirt somewhere completely, you know, irrelevant to the actual process and safety, but therefore, you know, we're taking actions against you. So we really wanted to minimize the risk that an inspector would sort of overreach and find excuses to penalize raw milk producers just based on personal ideology.
I mean, is that your sense? Do you feel that, do both of you, and Renee, I wanted to ask you about this as well, do you feel like this is a punitive move by the government, that they shouldn't really be doing this type of regulation, Renee?
I don't feel they need to, should be doing it, or that it's necessary. There was a study done by CDC over 10 or 14 year period. I have the web address. But in that amount of time, there was only 18 people in Illinois that got sick from raw milk, and it was isolated case of an Amish farm. It all came from the same place. And in that same time period, there was over 1,000 people that got sick from raw lettuce. So why is it that the dairy farmers are being regulated for raw milk when they're basing it on historical data, actually, rather than information that's current?
So you feel like you're being unfairly targeted.
Right.
Rebecca, what about, as you all are thinking about, as Renee said, some people did get sick. Certainly, I know there's always the balance of the public health aspect when you're in food production. Do you feel like these current regulations, do you feel like they're going overboard?
Well, I think it's more a matter of approach. So there have been, I think, a really good example to look to is Michigan. They had a work group convened that was made up of a pathologist, actual regulators, and farmers. And in the end, they concluded that regulation wasn't necessary, but the model that they that there was just one model that they promoted, and that was the herd share model, where people contractually actually purchase and own either a cow or a portion of a herd. And with that contractual relationship, they felt that there was enough of a nexus between the customer and the farmer that relationship was enough safeguard. So they opted to not regulate the industry. They just specified that it had to be distributed through herd shares and not just marketed to the public.
And Rebecca, do you feel like the current regulations now, do you think that how will this affect businesses of different farmers? Can they, do you think they can afford to do this?
Well, Renee actually, we're part of a working group together, and we hear all these farmers talking about selling their equipment, selling their cows. I think that without having an exemption for the really smallest farms with, say, you know, just a couple of cows where the primary purpose was to feed their family, but they sell a little bit to their neighbors. And also the regulations didn't allow for any kind of off-premises distribution. So that those two factors really constrained the opportunities for definitely the farmer demographic that Illinois Stewardship Alliance works with, the smaller farm.
Renee, how about you? I mean, are you going to continue to offer to sell raw milk under these regulations?
We're going to try. We're still not exactly sure what the inspectors are going to want. Reading over the regulations, it seems that they pulled some rules from grade A, and some are just things that they added. But I just talked to an inspector this morning, and it sounds like the way he's talking, it's going to be grade A plus. So we're going to be regulated beyond even grade A.
You mean you're going to be more regulated than pasteurized milk producers?
That's from talking to the inspector this morning. That's what it sounded like.
Can I ask you, for your family's farm, Renee, do you all produce? How did you get into the raw milk business? Do you only do raw milk, or do you? How big is your operation?
I'm milking 9 cows, and I don't ship milk. I just sell raw milk. My grandfather started here in the '40s, and my dad milked after that, and they both shipped to plants. And then my dad got out of it because it wasn't cost effective. So I wanted to still have dairy cows, and I was in 4-H. So that was the only way that I could get started in dairy, was to get a niche or get out. I couldn't get big because there's such a small margin on milk, you know, if you're shipping. So that's how I got started, was I wanted to milk cows. I wanted to milk cows for a living, and selling raw milk was the only way I could do it and get started.
And now I know, Renee, you've applied for a permit from the state to sell raw milk. Have you received that permit?
No.
But the regulations take effect on Friday.
I sent in the application almost 3 weeks ago, and I just got a call from the state. So I think it sounds like they're going to be lenient as far as if we're working on getting our permit, they will give us some leeway until we get to that point.
Renee, what do you want people to know about raw milk? For maybe people who are listening who've never bought raw milk or who are now hearing about these regulations for the first time, what do you want them to know about this issue?
Well, first of all, the health officials and the government are trying to scare people. In the past, you know, 100 years ago, when they started pasteurizing, there was a reason for pasteurization. There, we didn't have sanitation, we didn't have refrigeration, people were melting into a pail, who knows what was falling into the pail, it got sat alongside the road, it got shipped to the cities, and there was a lot of chance for people to get sick. Now we have sanitation, we have refrigeration, we know how bacteria works, and we can keep milk safe a lot more easily. And it's actually good for people. You know, it's not, people don't have to worry about getting sick because it isn't handled right. And if they're concerned about if it's being handled right, if people come to the farm, they are their own inspectors. They can walk around the farm, they can look at the cows, they can look at the equipment. If they have a problem with the milk in any way, they don't have to keep purchasing it from that particular farm.
Renee, how much are you selling your milk for?
Right now I'm selling it for $8 a gallon.
$8 a gallon.
I had to raise my price significantly.
Because of the regulations. All right. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us, taking the time to do so. That's Renee Koster. She sells raw milk from her family's farm in Dixon. I also want to thank Rebecca Oslin with the Illinois Stewardship Alliance. Coming up, we're going to be speaking to the Illinois Department of Public Health and the CDC about this issue. Stay tuned to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we're talking about raw milk. New state regulations take effect on Friday that oversees production and sale of raw milk in Illinois. According to Food Safety News, there are about 60 raw milk dairy farms throughout the state. We just heard from one of those in Dixon, Renee Koster. Let's talk to public health officials now about why these rules came out and what government officials say about the health of raw milk. Joining me on the line from Springfield, Molly Lamb is with the Illinois Department of Public Health. She's Assistant Deputy Director for the Office of Health Protection. Hi, Deputy Director, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. This is Molly. How are you?
Hi, Molly. I also want to welcome Megan Nichols. She's a veterinary epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Hi, Megan. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Molly, let's start with Illinois, because we just heard the producer say that they don't think people who drink raw milk have severe health problems. They think it's the government trying to scare people. Why did the Illinois Department of Public Health consider these regulations important?
The department's main goal was to provide an opportunity to make raw milk available and at the same time make it as safe as possible. So in fact, the department did not ban raw milk but made it legal in Illinois through these regulations.
And I wonder, Megan, if you could, you know, we were just hearing someone talk about, we were hearing from Renee talking about why her customers buy raw milk. She said that a lot of them seem that they have health problems when they have pasteurized milk. What is the CDC's perspective on, first of all, what the benefits of raw milk are?
Well, one of the things we do recommend is if you choose to drink milk, drink pasteurized milk. And if you don't drink milk, that there are many other ways to get the nutrients like calcium and protein that are really beneficial in milk products.
So from your perspective, you think that raw milk, would you say that you think raw milk is a dangerous thing for people to drink?
Well, in order to really understand that, I think one of the things we have to consider is how milk gets contaminated or how these germs get into milk in the first place. And this type of contamination can occur from cow feces coming into direct contact with the milk, infection in the cow's udder, that's also called mastitis. There are some diseases that cows get that can also infect humans. And then there's bacteria that live on the skin of cows that you can't see. In addition, cows live in an environment where there is feces and dirt. There oftentimes are insects, rodents, and other animal vectors. And there's also an opportunity for contamination of the milk from the environment. So I think in order to really understand the risks associated with raw milk, you have to understand the contamination. And that's why we say that really pasteurization is the only way to prevent those risks.
That's Megan Nichols. She's a veterinary epidemiologist with the CDC. We're also talking to IDPH's Molly Lamb about this issue. You're always welcome to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to David in Urbana. Hi, David. Your family had a dairy farm. What's your perspective on this?
I think anyone who drinks raw milk is an idiot.
Why is that?
It's very dangerous. Before pasteurization, it was a major factor in the spread of both brucellosis, undulant fever among humans, and tuberculosis. Contaminated milk caused a really epidemic incidence of tuberculosis in the late 1800s and early 1900s, right up until the 1940s.
David, thanks for that comment. I wonder, you know, we actually heard, and Megan, I wonder if you can address this. That's David's perspective. We heard a very different one from Renee earlier saying that was sort of before we had a lot of refrigeration and other regulations in place. And given it's 2016 and the modern technology we have, raw milk can be safe. Does the CDC agree with that?
Well, I think in that case, one of the things I would like to highlight is actually an outbreak that happened as a result of raw milk and was caused by infection with a germ called salmonella. And so in the investigation of this outbreak, it was an outbreak of salmonella infecting a school group. They were going on and onto this farm and visiting what appeared to be a really healthy cow herd. And what ended up causing the outbreak was that a single teat in a single cow in the herd was actually infected and resulted in the salmonella contamination of the milk. And really, there was nothing the farmer could have done to actually make that milk safe other than pasteurization. So even if something as small as one cow in a large herd can actually result in the contamination of raw milk, and the only way to really eliminate that contamination would be pasteurization.
Molly, can you talk a little bit about, can you explain a little bit about the current the regulations that will take effect on July 1st and what raw milk producers have to do to comply?
Yeah, sure. So Megan did a really great job of providing us reasons as to why we chose what the current regulations entail. And those are permit, sanitary standards, which means to target target equipment and milking parlor and practices on the farm, sampling, quality counts, testing of the raw milk, an inspection process, product labeling, consumer awareness, protection of vulnerable populations to make sure that the consumer's informed of the risk, and then opportunities to facilitate illness and product investigation if a problem exists.
And are those the same standards that are applied to pasteurized milk producers?
So what we did was we analyzed the current grade A regulations and we did utilize as a basis the grade A. However, we did also take in consideration not making it burdensome for the small farmers. So we did so in a way not to compromise the safety and the sanitary standards, but making them economical and flexible. So many of them are the same, but some do not compromise the safety, but just doing it a different way. And I can provide a couple of examples. For example, we don't, in the grade A program, you have to have a bulk tank. In the raw milk program, you do not. In the grade A program, you have to have a four-walled barn with a protected overhead. In the raw milk program, we're allowing a barn that maybe doesn't have four walls. And then also in the raw milk, we're saying you don't have to have electronic or any type of robotic type of milking. You can milk with a pail, a bucket, and by dry hand milking practices. So those are a couple examples.
That's Molly Lam with IDPH. We're also speaking to Megan Nichols. She's a veterinary epidemiologist with the CDC, and we're taking your calls on this. Our phone number, we're going to have this conversation for a few more minutes, is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Sean in Petersburg. Sean, you produce raw milk. Sean, are you there? Looks like we lost Sean. Sean, call back, but I know the point he wanted to make is, and Molly, I wonder if you could respond to this. He wanted to say that it's really expensive for him to follow these rules. Do you have a sense of how much it's, and I wonder if we're talking about small farmers like Renee, she's about 9 cows. Are there exemptions for small farms?
We have an exemption in our rules for a farmer who has is only going to produce milk for their family. They're exempt. Otherwise, if they're going to produce milk for sale, then they have to follow the regulation.
How many people have applied for a permit so far?
We have received 6 applications. 2 are really close to being permitted. The others are a little bit farther away. They're kind of sporadically across the top half of Illinois and about 4 of them in central Illinois between, you know, Peoria and Champaign areas.
Mm-hmm. And what does it take to obtain a permit?
So we've lined it up in 6 pretty quick, or not quick, but pretty easy steps to follow. If you go to our website and you go to the search box and you type raw milk packet, the packet will be the first that lines up on our website. And basically it's, you know, becoming familiar with the rules, preparing your farm per the standards, and making sure you have all the appropriate documentation, which we've even provided in this packet, such as the sales log and your consumer awareness, your product labeling. We provided those so then they can really just be utilized and tailored per each farm to help the farmer out. An application process. Farmers will have to be a certified sampler or utilize a certified sampler, you know, down the road. Or we've recommended and encouraged, you know, not everyone has to be. So if you want to collaborate with a fellow neighbor farmer, then that's a possibility. An on-site inspection and then quality count sampling of the raw milk.
It looks like we've got Sean back from Petersburg. Hey, Sean, are you there now?
Yes, I am here.
What comment? I know you produce raw milk. What comment did you want to make to IDPH?
Well, Molly Lamb, in the analysis, they did try to make it less burdensome to small farmers, and they did a cost analysis. And in that cost analysis, based on my production, it would require me to charge $5 per gallon more. But that cost analysis didn't include some equipment I had to buy, as well as my labor. And when I added that in, it's $28 per gallon in order to get permitted with the state of Illinois.
So are you going to be producing?
I can't produce. My customers won't pay $30-some per gallon of milk. So I'm essentially shut down.
Sean, thanks for that comment. Molly, I don't know if you have a response to the cost analysis into how much farmers are, how much you took into account how much farmers would have to pay to comply with the regulations?
Right. So we did analyze a cost analysis, but of course each farmer is going to be looking at their own operations and know that more intricately based on what their operations and their business practices. But what I do know is, you know, we did do as best as possible to, again, not compromise safety, but make economical and flexible choices in the regulation. And, you know, we're just implementing these rules. So we're going to learn a lot as we work with farmers, and we are willing and will be reevaluating after we have implementation and more data and more information to determine what we need to change as we move forward.
What are the repercussions if someone is selling without a permit?
We as a department have, as we learn about the operations from the public or from a fellow farmer that's permitted, perhaps, we will be following up and address the operation that's not permitted.
Megan, I just wanted to bring you back into this conversation just as we're wrapping up here and ask you about, you know, it sounds like this is a really passionate issue with people on both sides, as we've heard from our callers, of people who really are in favor of raw milk and people who think it's dangerous. I wonder what the CDC's thoughts are on how you regulate investigate this issue from a public health perspective. All of the, as we're hearing Molly and Renee talk about all of the regulations that need to be in place, how do you think the government should be weighing those benefits? I mean, those doing sort of that cost-risk analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, CDC is not a regulatory agency, so these laws are actually in the hands of states, and when it comes to interstate sale of milk, then it's in the hands of the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. Our job is really to provide good info for people to make healthy choices. So in many cases, there are parents out there that are trying to do something good for their children. And in the case of raw milk, consuming it is actually something that can make children sick. And there's a lot of unreliable and sometimes even dangerous information on the internet. So when parents have accurate information, they often make the right choices. And I think Dr. Lamb is absolutely right. There are certain groups that shouldn't necessarily consider drinking raw milk because the risk of infection and a severe outcome from that infection is so great. And that's infants and young children, older adults, pregnant women, and people who have weakened immune systems. So again, we emphasize that if you choose to drink milk and get the health benefits associated with milk, drink pasteurized milk.
That's Megan Nichols. She's a veterinary epidemiologist with the CDC on the line from Atlanta. Thanks also to Molly Liam, who's the with IDPH Assistant Deputy Director for the Office of Health Protection. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to everyone who called and tweeted as well. You're listening to The 21st. One more health issue for you. You know, it's not really the time of year to be thinking about flu season, but there is one reason to pay attention. A recent decision by a panel of experts, also from the CDC, is taking away one option for the flu vaccine this year. It's the flu mist. It's a popular, especially with children, because it doesn't require a shot, but simply inhaling it. And to explain, we called the American Academy of Pediatrics. They're based out just outside of Chicago. They put us in touch with Dr. Henry Bernstein. He's a professor of pediatrics at the Hofstra Northwell School of Medicine in New Hyde Park, New York. And Dr. Bernstein joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bernstein, an advisory panel with the CDC is recommending that this nasal spray version of the flu vaccine not be used. Why?
So an interesting thing has been found, and that is the performance of the LAIV vaccine, the intranasal product, has not performed nearly as well as anticipated, and dramatically so that it has not provided any protection for people that have received it.
Not provided any protection at all?
Virtually none, very small percentage.
And I know the panel
varies from season to season.
I see. Okay. And I know that the research was based for the 2015 to 2016 flu season, and the panel found no protective effect. Do we know why?
So we really don't know why. So there are some hypotheses out there that have been suggested. One of them is the fact that the strain that's in the influenza vaccine to protect against pandemic H1N1 perhaps wasn't as stable as it should be, and therefore the company has been working to improve the stability in order to make the vaccine more effective. Other suggestions include the fact that for many years, since the LAIV intranasal product was first licensed back in 2003, it was a trivalent vaccine. That means there were three strains in the vaccine itself. But 3 years ago, the company moved to a quadrivalent product, meaning there were now four influenza virus strains.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And in that, when that moved to quadrivalent, the last 3 years, we've identified that the LAIV intranasal just has not performed well at all.
We're going to take a break. Coming up, we're going to find out what people need to know going into this flu season with Dr. Bernstein. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the flu mist vaccine and it being declared pretty much ineffective by the CDC. On the line with us, a professor of pediatrics at Hofstra Northwell School of Medicine in New Hyde Park, New York. Dr. Henry Bernstein is with us. Dr. Bernstein, what do people need to know going into this next flu season? As we've been talking about this flu mist, basically the CDC found not really any protective effect could be measured for the last flu season. So should people not even be considering this for next year?
No, that is not the case. We still need to recognize that influenza, which is an unpredictable disease, causes significant illness and even death in healthy children and lots of adults every year. And flu vaccine is the best way to prevent influenza. So we are still recommending the influenza vaccine.
Just not the mist.
For all people, just right. Not the nasal spray.
Right, the nasal spray.
I should also mention just quickly, when we move from the 3-strain to the 4-strain version of the intranasal and saw poor performance, maybe that interference caused a problem, but we did not see the same experience when we gave the vaccine by injection.
How common is it to see a recommendation not to use a vaccine like this?
It's not a common experience, but I should say that all of this information that has been shared with the public really underscores the importance of the ongoing efforts to measure and evaluate the effectiveness of these public health interventions, such as the vaccine effectiveness. So we really need to applaud the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for their ongoing evaluation of the performance of influenza vaccines each and every year, because that kind of information has significant implications for public health policy. In this case, people will only be able to get a shot this year to be protected against the flu, where in the recent past they've been able to choose between the nasal spray and the shot.
I should point out that AstraZeneca, the company that makes flu mist, says its own data shows it's much more effective than what the CDC information is indicating. Does that mean now that the CDC has made this recommendation, I wonder what happens now? Do doctors' offices, are they still allowed to offer it? Where do the regulations go from here?
So from this perspective, remember that the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics
don't do regulation. The FDA
recommendations.
Does.
Correct. Right. And the FDA is looking very closely at this poor performance of the LAIV-4, the quadrivalent product, and what decision they will make will come over time after they've done a thorough evaluation. But at this point, for the coming year, LAIV, the intranasal product, will not be available, so no one in the United States should be receiving the intranasal product.
Oh, so it's not even available.
Correct.
Are you reaching out to families and parents, especially parents, I think, ahead of the fall, to warn them that maybe a lot more children may be unfortunately getting shots? From their perspective, not a fun thing, but as you're saying, something really important for the vaccination to protect them against influenza.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, you've touched on a most important point, and that is the importance of messaging and communication around the decision not to recommend the intranasal product this year, but to highlight that influenza vaccine is still critically important, the best way to prevent influenza, and therefore people should still get it as universally recommended, all ages from 6 months on up.
Dr. Bernstein is a pediatrician in New Hyde Park, New York, an ex officio member of the Committee on Infectious Diseases for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thanks for taking the time to be with us, Dr. Bernstein.
My pleasure. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share this important information for families.
As many are aware, we have a big deadline coming up this Friday. It's the end of the fiscal year for the state of Illinois on June 30, which is Thursday. And we're hearing lots of concern from different state agencies and other groups saying, since we haven't had a state budget for this entire year, what's going to happen come Friday? Well, there's a lot of action today. Governor Rauner has just introduced his own version of an updated version of his stopgap funding that he'd like to see passed. Republicans have been introducing that this morning in Springfield. There's what Governor Rauner said in a statement that he just released a couple of hours ago. He's saying that it's really important that this stopgap funding he's proposing passes. And he said, I've said it before and I'll say it again today. We must not bail out a broken system that refuses to change the way it does business. That's why this bill will provide funding for higher education and for some critical government functions. He says it will not include what he's calling a bailout of Chicago public school systems. Well, yesterday, faculty members from across the state signed an open letter that was published in the Chicago Sun-Times calling on Illinois to fully reinstate higher education funding. The headline was to Governor Rauner that he's causing students to not enroll in universities. And the letter was penned by two University of Illinois professors, Dana Rabin, who's an associate professor of history, and Kathy Prendergast, who teaches English at the University of Illinois. It was signed by 262 of their colleagues throughout the state. The professors are in studio with me now. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Kathy, can you tell me about the letter? What was the impetus for this?
Well, Dana came up with the idea. We just felt an urgent need to respond to the crisis. We've been living a year now without a budget and seeing the fallout, not just at our campus, but across campuses all over the state, from the community colleges to the higher ed research university level.
Dana, I wonder why the Sun-Times, what message did you want to send to everybody who was reading this about what's going on at the state universities?
Well, we wanted to talk beyond our very local audience. We've been speaking amongst ourselves about these concerns for a long time, and we wanted to broadcast our message beyond that. We very much believe that this is a state crisis, not just for the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, but across all the state to all public universities and public schools.
Who did you all reach out to sign the letter?
I reached out to people across campus. I very much wanted representation from every one of our colleges. We didn't quite get there, but we do have people across the university. The two of us are in LAS, and so we wanted to go beyond that.
And then I took the job on of reaching colleges, beyond Urbana-Champaign. So people at Chicago State, Eastern Illinois,
Northeastern, UIC. Those
yes.
are all different people who have some
yes.
community colleges have also signed
yes.
on to this.
Yes. And we, I think, have demonstrated through this letter that we are capable of organizing across campuses to address these crises.
Kathy, have you seen people leave or not accept offers from the University of Illinois because of the current budget impasse?
Yeah, I mean, more than we, can really happily say. I've in my own department, we've lost three people. And at this point, we've become very cheap since we haven't had a raise in some years.
Dana, you were actually on sabbatical this past year.
Yeah.
What was it like to come back now on campus compared to what it was like before you left?
Well, I've been on sabbatical this past semester, and the morale is low. And I feel like people are upset. There's a great deal of uncertainty and instability, and a feeling that we feel the ground shifting under our feet.
We just got a comment on Facebook from Brad, a professor at Eastern Illinois University. He says his concerns are that no one really seems to know the end game here. What are the goals of these tactics at the state government level? Shut us down, rebuild, reorganize? If we had some perspective, it would be less intimidating. Brad says, I'm saddened by what has happened to EIU in particular. As an alum and a current faculty member, I've seen the effects. The comparisons between 1990s and today are staggering. Meanwhile, we're losing great faculty and great students every week, it seems, and I don't blame them. Kathy, are you concerned the same thing's going to happen at the University of Illinois?
Well, very much so. I have been here since the late 1990s. I was employed here starting in 1997, and I've seen a great shift in the prominence of and stability of our university right here. I've also been watching what happens across the state. I think people don't understand that many of our students start out at community college and then come to UIUC. We're all connected, and so this crisis affects all of us. And the attempt, I think, to divide and conquer and think we're going to shrug and say, oh, well, that campus is doing badly, but we'll be all right for a while, that's not the message we're sending.
I want to talk about what Governor Rauner has proposed this morning, and in particular with this his revised sort of updated stopgap measure. He is saying that he's actually proposing $1 billion for state universities, and I want to get to this also because I know we have students who have commented, $151 million for MAP grant funding. Again, those are grants for students to help attend university. So higher ed funding of $1 billion, that's on top of the $600 million, so $600 million was approved in April, and that was, we know that $600 million was a big cut compared to previous years. I wanted to ask both of you what you think about what the governor's proposing about $1 billion for the state university system. Kathy?
Well, the first thing I'd say is we want a real budget. The stopgap is not the ideal solution in any case. It doesn't provide any stability or the ability to plan for the future. The second thing I'd say is that comes with his saying that we must not bail out Chicago public schools. And I believe our letter in citing Article 10 of the Illinois Constitution shows that it is a constitutional responsibility of the state to fund public education from kindergarten through 12th grade to higher education. And so to think that, you know, we can take from one area and then slight the other doesn't work.
Dana, what's your...
Well, I totally agree with what Kathy said, but I also want to, you know, just emphasize that those are our students. Those are our future students. And so starving out CPS is not going to help anybody, especially around issues of diversity. We need to recruit more people from Chicago public schools and not have them, you know, not even be able to be in the system.
Donna, I wanted to also ask about the MAP grant funding. And we had some comments. In fact, we've got Samantha, a student at Augustina College in Rock Island, said school is definitely harder with the loss of the MAP grant. And she said Augustana has tried to compensate, but they're still continuing to raise tuition, which really doesn't solve anything. Throughout my college experience, I've worked two jobs off campus in order to earn money to try to help my parents. It just isn't enough. And to see that we're virtually required to have a degree, yet it's continually devalued at the same time, is very frustrating. Why did you guys write this letter to the governor and not to Speaker Madigan or to Senate President Cullerton? Certainly all of them are in leadership. And
they do bear responsibility, absolutely. But the buck stops with the governor. He is supposed to shepherd this through. And so I do see him as holding the bag. I also want to say that, you know, the uncertainty and instability that these students are facing, we see it in the classroom. We're very, very concerned about it. It makes our job, that's another thing, another responsibility we have as professors, is to help them get through. And they're under a great deal of stress. And we wanted to speak out about this so that people know that we are listening. U of I sometimes is in a more protected position, and we want to speak out.
Why did you all specifically speak out in a Chicago publication? Do you feel like this attention, attention to the state budget impasse, do you think that it's getting enough attention among the general population throughout Illinois? Donna?
I'm surprised by the lack of response. I thought that more people would be upset and marching, I don't know, protest letters. I'm not seeing as much of a response as I would have expected.
Well, do you think that's why there hasn't been a solution? Kathy?
I would say that, you know, one thing that I notice when sending out this call to other campuses is the amount of gratitude that somebody was doing something. I think people are a little paralyzed thinking what can be done, and that can lead to inaction. But it just takes some small actions, however imperfect, to get the ball rolling and to make a voice heard wherever you can. And some people said, well, you should open the letter to business people and community people who are also affected. And my answer was, start another letter. we can't have enough of these, you know, and you can testify to your experience, too. Everybody's responsibility as a citizen is to find whatever venue to do that.
What kind of response have you all gotten from the letter, Kathy?
Well, last night I saw it was shared like 1,000 times or more on Facebook. And I love social media because that really, you know, we weren't able to touch every campus or every community college, but then it broadens out. And you can't tell what, you know, the impact will be from there. But I will say it was amazing to me how many people at other campuses wanted to do something. And so their unions mobilized to add signatures, you know, through them. And so there's a lot more organization than on the ground than people would suspect.
That's Kathy Prendergast. She teaches English at the University of Illinois with her colleague in the history department, Donna Rabin, also at the University of Illinois, part of 264 people who signed that letter to the Chicago Sun-Times about the current budget impasse. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.